I'm Lisa Clive, the European MedTech analyst here at Bernstein, and I'm delighted to welcome Stefan Sturm, the CEO of Fresenius SE, to present to us today. Fresenius SE is a global healthcare group that includes four independently operated businesses, each one in a major growth area of healthcare. Fresenius Medical Care, which is also an independently traded company, is the world's leader in treating people with chronic kidney disease. Fresenius Helios is Germany's largest hospital operator. Fresenius Kabi supplies essential drugs, clinical nutrition products, medical devices, and services to help critically ill and chronically ill patients, while Fresenius Vamed plans, develops, and manages healthcare facilities around the world. Mr. Sturm joined Fresenius in 2005 as CFO. He was appointed chairman of the management board, equivalent to president and CEO, on July 1st, 2016. So he's been very actively involved with this company for a long time and now is at the helm. Before joining Fresenius, Mr. Sturm worked in investment banking and consulting at firms including McKinsey and Credit Suisse First Boston, where we briefly overlapped many years ago, and ran head of investment banking for Germany and Austria until he joined Fresenius. Mr. Sturm will spend about 25 minutes on some prepared remarks, giving us an overview of Fresenius SE and its future trajectory, and then we'll turn it over to Q&A, and you have cards that you can write questions down that will be handed up to me. With that, I will turn it over to Stefan. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, Lisa. And good morning, all. Pleasure to be here. Thank you for your interest. Lisa just mentioned it. I'm in my new job for about 10 weeks now, and about the most frequently asked question is, so, Stefan, what's going to change? What are you going to do differently? Well, if you are a shareholder like me, then probably you don't want me to do that many things differently, because then you should be happy, just like me, with the performance of the company and with the performance of the share price. Frankly, also, what I would claim is that, at least at Fresenius, it was sort of different to what the typical picture from the outside world is, that the CEO sits in his magic ivory tower and takes the big strategic decision and sends the troops. And before he does that, he rings me in the engine room and says, actually, can we finance this? That's not the way it worked. And Mark and I had a very close collaboration also in anything that was strategic. Mark used to be a CFO himself before he took the helm at Fresenius, and therefore he also knew how to add up numbers. Therefore, in my mind, not that much is going to change in my day-to-day life. And not that much should change for Fresenius as a whole. Not that much should change in 2016 to start with. And in my mind, 2016 for Fresenius is going to be yet another year where we show very meaningful top-line growth, leading to even higher growth in our earnings after tax. We started off the year also, as you know us, fairly conservatively, taking a more conservative view on the development, in particular in our North American business for injectable drugs at Fresenius Kabi. And therefore, we were only guiding to an 8 to 12% currency-adjusted earnings growth. At the half-year mark, in particular, because we were positively surprised by the outperformance in our North American injectables business, we're showing 18% currency-adjusted earnings growth, and primarily because we're up against fairly solid, tough comps in the second half of 2015. We're still projecting a slowdown of growth in the second half, but still feel very comfortable to guide you to now 11 to 14% currency-adjusted earnings growth. All of our four businesses, Lisa just gave you the highlights of them, are meant to make a solid positive contribution to that overall earnings growth. Fresenius Medical Care, the world leader in dialysis, I will be extremely brief on because they are presenting separately at this conference tomorrow. Anything you'd like to know about dialysis, the answers will be provided tomorrow. But they are projected to grow their earnings by 15 to 20% this year. Now, wait a minute, you may say, FMC 15 to 20, but the group only 11 to 14, so is the rest of the group showing negative growth? Not true. We only own a 31%, but still controlling stake in Fresenius Medical Care, and therefore that 15 to 20% earnings growth translates to round about 4 points of earnings growth once you deduct the minorities at the group level. So all the other three businesses are also making a very solid, positive contribution. That is particularly true for Fresenius Kabi and North America, where the outperformance in our injectable drugs, driven by what you probably know as the drug shortage phenomenon, continues to exceed our expectations. Lisa, I'm pretty certain that some of the questions, either from the auditorium or from you, will focus around how long is this drug shortage phenomenon going to last. I have no definitive answer for that. My crystal ball isn't any clearer than yours. We're still somewhat taken aback that it has taken so long for many of our competitors to get their issues with the FDA sorted out. The last thing I want to do is come across as being arrogant, which is why I knock wood and say we are very much focused on our internal housekeeping matters on the two large manufacturing sites that we have in the US and try to stay in the clear and in the FDA's good books. As far as our German hospital business is concerned, we've had a very good start to the year. Organic growth in the first half was almost 4.5%, so more towards the upper end of our 3 to 5% guidance range. And as you would expect, working with operating leverage, earnings growth has surpassed the top-line growth level. Also there, we are on a very good track to meet our full-year guidance. We caught most of the headlines recently, and that is what I want to spend a bit of time on, with the largest acquisition in Fresenius' history. We spent approximately 5.8 billion euros by signing a purchase contract for Quirón Salud. Quirón Salud is Spain's largest hospital operator. We announced the transaction on Labor Day, and we would expect it to close by the end of the year or early 2017. Why go abroad when ever since we acquired Helios in 2005, we were so much focused on Germany and Germany only? It is both, in my mind, a defensive and just as much an offensive move. Defensive, because as Fresenius, we only ever want to be active in businesses where we have both organic and non-organic growth opportunities. I was just referring to the organic growth in Germany, and that continues to be very solid. But non-organic, that's the piece that's missing. Relative to the original expectations, the concept of hospital privatizations in Germany has never really caught on. And as far as all the private competitors that were available, we pretty much have acquired them. And therefore, the non-organic growth component in Germany, in our minds, that looked a bit dire. We therefore felt, despite some initial skepticism whether cross-border synergies would exist in the hospital business, that we should take a closer look and were increasingly intrigued. We were doing a bottom-up just as much as a top-down analysis. Bottom-up, looking at where are more advanced healthcare regulatory systems, in particular hospital regulatory systems, than in Germany, which in our minds needs a bit of a refresh. And we pretty quickly came across Spain, where we saw quite some favorable characteristics, not only for the government, but also for the patients and for the operators. And as far as our top-down analysis was concerned, we had always held the view, if we were to go abroad, then this must not be a greenfield exercise or just a rifle shot buying a single hospital. This would have to be a platform. Quirónsalud happens to be the largest hospital operator in Europe outside Germany, and therefore they also came very quickly on our radar screen. Now, I don't want to bore you with too many regulatory details, but what has intrigued me right from the beginning was that Spain, in my mind, got it very right as far as the overall supply of patients in an hospitalization setting is concerned. The one school of thought would say you do an activity-based reimbursement. You do a procedure, you get a reimbursement based on a DRG. History would tell you, any health economist would tell you, that this arguably leads to oversupply. And many procedures are being done that aren't truly necessary. The other extreme has been tried in the US, that is the capitation fee. Yeah, and you get a lump sum reimbursement for a certain part of the population. You get that irrespective of whether that population comes to your hospital or not. That has also proven to be setting the wrong incentives and arguably leads to undersupply. Now, what the Spaniards have done is that they have chosen the capitation fee model for their public hospitals, but have added to it a corrective element in the form of what they call the free choice. So in an extreme scenario, if a patient that was assigned to your hospital as part of such a capitation fee model would be sent home again. No, you're not sick, go home. Yeah, they always have the choice to go somewhere else without having to pay up. Who pays the bill then? The hospital that was actually responsible. And therefore, as a near priority for us going forward in those public-private partnership situations, we've got to make sure that all the patients that are being assigned to us are being treated and are being treated well, while managing our cost base. At the same time, what we can focus on is to try and convince patients that are not assigned to us to be treated with us, because we have shorter waiting times, because we have superior quality. Yeah? And that is where you can make the entire situation a bit more favorable for the government, for the patient, and also for us. That is what has intrigued me ever since I saw that system. I would not be surprised at all if that caught on also in other parts of the world, other parts of Europe first and foremost. And that is why I felt on the spot, this is something that I would like to learn more about on the job, so that we know how to deal with it if it ever comes, if it ever came to Germany. There are other very favorable characteristics of that system. In particular, it's a much better and closer interaction between inpatient and outpatient services. In Spain, the default is that you come to a hospital, you're getting treated and are being sent home again. In Germany, the default is you come to a hospital, you're being treated, you're being hospitalized, you stay there for a number of days. I don't think that in very many cases that is necessary, and also here there's quite something that we can learn from our new Spanish colleagues. When we thought about going abroad, there was one thing also that was very clear to me in my mind. We had done a very successful transaction by acquiring the number two in the German hospital market in 2013. We were paying a bit above 11 times EBITDA for that. It proved to be highly accretive to our financial ratios. I said, if we go into uncharted territories for our hospital business, then I would like to be compensated for that incremental risk with a multiple discount. And therefore, we're now paying multiple-wise about 10% less than what we were paying for Rhön. That is exactly what I was looking for. The company that we're acquiring is substantially profitable. The margin is actually higher than the one that we have in our home market in Germany, and we expect EBITDA to grow also going forward. What we have guided to as part of our announcement of the acquisition is an EBITDA in a range between 520 and 550 million euros in 2017. And that would be up from this year's estimate of 460 to 480 million euros. Now, where is that EBITDA growth coming from? Is that all synergies? No. Any synergy between Helios and Quirónsalud would come on top. And we don't think that synergies, whilst they absolutely do exist, will come about in such short order. In any case, we've been sufficiently conservative not to include them into our 2017 projections. The EBITDA growth is coming from synergy benefits within Spain. What you need to know is that the company that we're about to acquire now is the result of a very recent merger of the number two and the number two in the Spanish hospital operators market. And as you would expect, with a bit of time lag, if those two companies like this come together, there are substantial synergies to be had. Many of them are realized already, and that growth that we're projecting for 2017 is merely an annualization effect where we have the full 12-month exposure to that very same benefit. So I'm reasonably comfortable with that 520 to 550 guidance range. Many of you have already asked me, okay, it's fine, we get it. Organic and non-organic growth. So you did buy into Spain also for the non-organic growth opportunity. And on the one hand, that is true. And the Spanish market is even more fragmented than the German is. Quirónsalud is about six times the size of the number two in the Spanish market. We are only about double the size of the number two in Germany. But frankly, getting that 2017 projection, that is of the highest priority, and in good old Fresenius fashion, you got to earn the right to spend capital first before you are allowed to make major investments, let alone acquisitions. So I wouldn't rule a further consolidation in Spain out, but that, in my mind, should be reserved for 2018 and beyond. The acquisition does have an effect on our medium-term targets for the group. Earlier this year, in February, we were facing the fact that based on our 2015 results, we had accomplished our 2017 medium-term target already 2 years ahead of time, so it was time to issue new targets. Those did foresee 36 to 40 billion euros in group sales by 2019, combined with earnings after tax between 2 and 2.25 billion. Those medium-term targets were published with the understanding that they are set on an about unchanged currency regime, but also with the understanding that any more meaningful acquisition would have to come on top and would have to be reflected in revised medium-term targets. Quirónsalud clearly qualifies for a larger acquisition that triggers a revision of these old medium-term targets. we always felt that the right point in time to publish medium-term targets is us commenting on our full-year results. So give us a bit more time, please, but inevitably, these old medium-term targets are outdated now, and we're going to provide you with a new set of not less ambitious growth targets on the occasion of publishing our full-year 16 results February next year. Those are my prepared comments, about 20 minutes, 25 minutes left. Thank you for your attention so far. I'll be more than happy to answer your questions, also your questions, Lisa. Thank you.
Great, excellent. Thank you very much, Stefan. Again, you have cards on your seats, so if you do have any questions, please write them down and someone will come around to collect them and pass them up to me. So I will start with a few of my own, starting with the Curon Salud acquisition, as it's very topical. One thing that you've often talked about that is attractive about the German market is the level of public funding for hospitals that essentially allows you to commit less capital and have better sort of return on invested capital for your German hospital network. Could you explain how the capital requirements perhaps differ in Spain or whether that's something that we should think about in terms of return metrics?
I actually did say that, Lisa, that's correct. And it was primarily meant as a corrective statement when people did approach me about the seemingly very high capital intensity in the German hospital business. And it is substantially less than what you would think, because as part of any hospital privatization that we've done, we were hardly paying a purchase price. We were most of the time doing it because the selling community, the selling municipality, couldn't do what they were forced to do, namely to build a new hospital building. And therefore, the purchase price was a quasi-CAPEX measure, which was then also typically subsidized by further grants from that selling municipality, and they provided what they could. As a run rate, CAPEX in our existing German hospital business is somewhere between 4 and 5% of revenue. In Spain, you don't have the type of privatization that I was just describing for Germany, and therefore there is no purchase price to be paid. The Spanish way of privatization is these PPPs, the public-private partnerships, that are fairly capital light, at least as far as a purchase price on the outset is concerned. We've done intensive due diligence across the Curon Salud hospital network, and we found them generally in at least as good a state as our Helios hospitals. We also found that in particular, as far as the medical equipment is concerned, they are arguably even more advanced than we in Germany are and have very many items that we in Germany felt we couldn't afford. And therefore, in our projections, we're working on the assumption that no near-term bolus CAPEX is required. We have not found any incident for that. And that also the run rate for CAPEX is rather 4 than 5% of revenue.
One other question regarding some relatively recent legislation in Germany. I believe it was in December of 2015 that there was a bill that was passed that was going to, at some point in the next few years, introduce pay for performance in Germany. I mean, one of the things that Helios has often talked about is your great quality metrics, the fact that you actually publish these publicly, and in the hopes that someday there would be a payment mechanism that would incorporate a reward for that, and it sounds like Germany's moving in that direction. So I've sort of a two-part question on this. First is, do you have any update on sort of how the working group that is supposed to be designing this is coming along and when you think this could possibly be implemented, and then ultimately what do you think the financial implications are for that?
You are right, that bill has been passed, and it's generally a step in the right direction, but as so often, from a corporate perspective in Germany, it is a lackluster, not sufficiently decisive move, with quite a few socialist elements into it. But what is good is that there will be an absolute mandatory obligation for all hospitals to measure their quality and to publish them. So the increasingly informed and the increasingly mobile patient will then, in all likelihood, vote with their feet. And the key decision-making criteria for a hospital right now, and that is proximity to your residence, is going to wane in importance relative to objective quality parameters. That would be good for us already in the first place and probably has the much larger effect. We're not that clear yet, though, what the requirement exactly is going to be to publish medical quality. And that is what I mean with the few socialist elements. In an extreme scenario, which, however, is very much conceivable, the top 10% performers and the bottom 10% performers will be identified, and then you have that gray mass in the middle where it's really at. And no patient could differentiate within that 80% where they should go. And my hunch is also that those top 10% will get a bit of extra, the bottom 10% will get a bit of a discount, and that nothing's going to change for the for this gray mass of the 80% in the middle. At least that is my concern. That is what we are using as the somewhat conservative base case assumption. Anything that is a bit more transparent and a bit more differentiated will be good for us.
And another question, given your move into Spain, I suppose one of the risks of moving outside of your home country is clearly within Germany, your organization has deep relationships with the decision makers in Germany, and perhaps that is the sort of thing that enables a bill like that to get passed. Is that something that we should be concerned about with Spain, that clearly you don't have long-standing relationships with government decision makers who can make very drastic changes, you know, to reimbursement, et cetera, you know, during periods of austerity? How do we think about that as a potential risk to this new business?
On Germany, yes, you're right. We are deeply ingrained in the political system. However, in particular, the representatives of the public hospitals are at least as well ingrained into that system, and that is why we don't see that much progress, as much progress as we would like to see. For Spain, don't work on the assumption that we are going to invade Spain and are going to tell our new Spanish colleagues how to run the hospital. Yeah, they are more profitable than we are. They know quite a few things about how to run a hospital. And maybe unlike your typical German, we are very respectful of cultural differences. So this is going to be an integration process where we will try and identify best practice. And I have no doubt that we will find quite a lot of best practice in Spain and will adopt it to the mutual benefit of the two hospital groups. And therefore, you should also not work on the assumption that we plan any major management change in Spain. Much rather, we're working on the assumption that the existing Spanish management team will stay in place. The founder and CEO, Victor Madera, he has committed to stay on, and he had a major stake in Quirón Salud and therefore has now also received a major consideration. But I have asked him, and he gladly accepted, to take 400 million euros of the consideration that is due to him in the form of Fresenius shares. Not because I needed that to put too much stress on our balance sheet, rather the opposite, but I wanted to be in a position to stand here this morning and to tell you Mr. Madeira's interests and those of Fresenius are very much aligned.
And you mentioned the profitability of this business, which is very attractive. Could you make some comments on why exactly it is more profitable than the base Helios business? Is it a patient mix issue? I understand there's a higher proportion of the Spanish market has private insurance. Is it different staffing ratios? I mean, how do we think about that?
Staffing is actually a bit higher than in Germany, and therefore that is not the reason. Two key reasons that I do see, and I was referring to both already. One is the closer interaction between in and outpatient services, and whereas in Germany, from regulation, we are actually penalized to provide outpatient services, it's the other way around in Spain. And therefore, this is, as I mentioned, a win-win-win. Yeah, very many patients don't realize how dangerous a hospital is. Whenever I need to go to a hospital, I want to leave as fast as I can. But in the German culture, you somewhat feel well taken care of in a hospital. And believe me, irrespective of how much we spend on hygiene, it is a dangerous place. You don't want to go there. So that is a major difference, and the outpatient service can be had more profitably. And secondly, it is that public-private partnership with the capitation fee, which in itself isn't that profitable. It's okay, but not that profitable. The free choice, that is what makes it fairly attractive. Because when you think about it, from that capitation fee that we do receive, that basically covers the fixed cost of a hospital already. And if we then manage to attract patients that are not assigned to us and get an activity-based reimbursement, that is only the variable cost, but almost all of the DRG. Yeah, so that is a fairly attractive business. In Germany, again, we're being penalized for doing something like this. In Germany, we're having a fixed budget. We agree on patient numbers or on case numbers with the insurance company. If we exceed that budget, we get a discount between 30 and 50%. Yeah, and therefore, that is still attractive business, and we do it. But it is margin dilutive. These extra free choice patients are fairly profitable in Spain. Those are the two key differences.
Okay. Very interesting. I'll switch over to Kabi and ask a range of questions on that. You mentioned up front, and thank you for preempting the question, because I'm sure it's the number one question you get, around the drug shortages. Are you still benefiting? How much longer will they last? I suppose I'll narrow my question to be a bit more specific. Back in 2013, something like 30 of your molecules were in shortage. And in Q2 of this year, it was only 17. So we appear to be approaching something of a normal environment. Yet, you still have, you know, sort of record-breaking margins. How do we sort of reconcile that? Are we really through the shortages to some extent? Or are there still sort of very unusual situations where you are benefiting from a lack of competition?
The numbers that you quote are spot on, and therefore I will not dispute that we are in a trend towards normalization. However, what normalization or what the new normal is, that is a separate discussion to be had. And in my mind, for a developed country, the ultimate developed country like the U.S., to have more or less simple liquid drugs in short supply, that can't be a normal situation. However, it looks like that the new normal is a certain base layer of drugs that will continue to be in short supply. My actual answer to your question is that when you quote these numbers, they relate to the FDA's formally published drug shortage list. And I can assure you that there is a good life beyond that drug shortage list. And my favorite example in that respect continues to be the world famous propofol, world leading anesthetic. At different points in time in the US, we were sole suppliers of this all important drug. In the meantime, there are six competitors, and therefore it has been removed from the drug shortage list for a long time already. We still hold on to a 76% market share, which in our minds is not normal. Yeah. So irrespective of whether a drug features on that list, there are still capacity constraints and supply shortages in that market, competitors focusing on drugs where they feel they will have a better business, much rather than competing with us, where we used the interim period when we were a sole supplier not to raise prices, not to rip off customers, but to enter into more contracts with large GPOs and therefore to solidify our business and make sure that there is a bit of stickiness in our business. And that is what, in particular, in this propofol situation, now seems to be paying off.
And in my understanding, there's a few molecules in particular where you have a slight differentiation. You know, people look at these as generic injectables, but actually some of yours are technically branded and have differentiation versus your competitors, which my understanding is that's one of the reasons why you can hold relatively decent market share. How sustainable is that? And I know one of the things that Kabi's very focused on is trying to come up with new formulations that are a bit differentiated. How much of a competitive advantage do you have in that, and does that help support the margins?
Lisa, what you're referring to are a few outlier situations, I would say, in our overall portfolio, and the vast majority of it is truly genericized liquid drugs that are replaceable with anything that a competitor has to offer, provided they can supply it in sufficient volumes and in a good reliability. But what you're saying is also right. We are working quite intensely, not only on replenishing our ANDA pipeline, but arguably growing it. At the moment, we're looking at around about 50 ANDAs that are sitting with the FDA. As far as I can see, all of them are valuable and can be launched once they are approved. And therefore, judging from current and past experience, that it takes around 3 years for an ANDA to get through the FDA, I am not worried that for the time being we will be good to our guidance that we can launch somewhere between 6 and 10 drugs per year. Against the scope, the size of our pipeline, that should actually be a conservative guidance.
Turning to the political scene in the U.S., recently Hillary proposed government oversight of generic drug pricing. Do you have any thoughts on this? Is this a potential risk? I mean, how feasible is it? It's one thing to propose oversight. It's another thing to actually have any influence.
Look, there were quite a few situations that caught the headlines. And I'm very glad to report we were nowhere near any of them. And I would always maintain that we are much rather part of the solution part of the issue.
For those in the audience, I think probably the two that have ended up on the front page of the Wall Street Journal are Turing and Valiant in that respect.
The average price point in our liquid drug portfolio is $5.50. Okay? The average price increase across our portfolio over the last 3 years has been between 1% and 2%. And that includes those situations where all of a sudden we were sole supplier because one of our competitors failed, and therefore, and that is the US system, the default is a predetermined list price, which is higher than the contractually agreed price. But there was no active doing by us in that context. Leave that aside. I'm struggling to see how that concept of oversight in our environment is meant to work. Because frankly, we have no direct interaction with an insurance company, with a patient. We do transactions, frankly, between two consenting adults. A GPO, which is a mammoth organization, and us as a supplier. Two private enterprises, yeah, that enter into a contract. The government gets only in very indirectly by providing DRG reimbursement to the hospital. The hospital then needs to see how they manage their cost position. Liquid drugs are a minor portion of that overall cost base. Final comment. We're not only supplying these drugs to public hospitals, also to private, also to stock-listed hospital companies. I'm not so sure whether Hillary is keen on presenting a gift to HCA shareholders. I can't imagine that that's the case.
Okay, excellent. Thank you for those perspectives. One question, not on the IV generics business, but rather on infusion therapy. So earlier this year, when you bought the portfolio of drugs from Becton Dickinson, you also signed a 10-year supply agreement with BD to provide them with infusion therapy. Historically, this has been a market that has really just been dominated by Baxter and Hospira, and you haven't had a role at all. And per the latest comments from the company, this has clearly changed on the back of this deal. Could you talk about the opportunities in the U.S. infusion therapy market? I mean, this is several billion dollars worth of market up for grabs. And how is that deal with BD progressing, and when can we actually see a real contribution to revenues and profits?
We have 3.5 minutes left. This is going to be tight for a question like this. Very much in line with my predecessor, we have absolutely been aligned in the view that for the four business lines that Kabi has, injectables, clinical nutrition, infusion solution, and medical devices, we would like to see them more evenly spread across the world. And the U.S. in our business is very much dominated by IV generics. We'd like to see more action in clinical nutrition, also in infusion therapies. Becton Dickinson, by the way, is a reflection of the growing importance of the GPOs that I was just referring to. With just 7 drugs in their portfolio, they realized that they had to give it to someone who had a broader and deeper portfolio. And as part of this transaction, they also entered into a supply agreement with us, also as a reflection of the growing importance of bundled transactions with the GPOs. They wanted to sell their infusion pumps with the infusion solutions that come with it. We always wanted to be there in infusion solutions, but it was clear to us that a greenfield approach would inevitably lead to a price war, and those fine competitors that you just mentioned would try and throw us back into the ocean. That 10-year supply agreement with a very potent customer like Becton Dickinson at a fixed price is a game changer in that respect. Because if you can rely on very steady demand, then all of a sudden the greenfield option becomes much more viable. And I'm not saying that necessarily we're going to go down that route. We're still investigating a few alternatives. But if there's one thing in life that you can't have enough of, then it's options. And that is just one additional option that we will always use as a benchmark for whatever we do.
Right. Well, with that, we have reached time. Thank you, everybody, for attending. And Stefan, particularly a big thank you to you for being here with us at the conference. It's been a delight having you.
Very happy to. Thank you for your attention. Thank you.